It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we talk with several columnists about their work and the issues they choose to address in their writing. Later in the hour, Rekha Basu will be with us and Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register, two columnists with that paper. And also joining us, editorial cartoonist Brian Duffy, three names known well to Iowans if you've lived here any length of time. Those coming up in the second half hour. But first, Leonard Pitts Jr. is visiting Iowa. Pitts is a nationally syndicated columnist for the Miami Herald, winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for commentary. He's also an author, most recently, of the novel Freeman. And this evening, Monday, May 12th, the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa is hosting Leonard Pitts Jr. as its keynote speaker for their Protecting Faith and Freedom Annual Award Dinner in Des Moines. Leonard Pitts joins us now in our Des Moines studio. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start off with the engagement you have tonight. Why is it important for you to speak at the Interfaith Alliance dinner? What message do you have?
Well, I think it's important to speak anywhere that we're trying to promote civility and perhaps a reimagining of the role of faith in politics from what it has been over so much of the last 20 years. I would like to think that faith can be used as a force for good, as a force for perhaps reaching out to the most vulnerable of our citizens, as opposed to a force for bashing them upside the head, metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm. How did we get to the point that with religion and politics that you don't like?
I think that what happened 30, maybe 40 years ago was that, in effect, the left, the political left, sort of ceded the whole idea of religiosity to the political right. I wrote a column once, maybe 5, 6, maybe 10 years ago, asking whatever happened to left-wing Christians, because I distinctly remember when I was a child that the message of Christianity was being sold by, you know, stereotypically speaking, but by long-haired kids in VW buses, the Jesus children. And we seem to have come from that to an idea of the gospel of Christ as being sort of this corporate thing that is almost a subsidiary of the Republican Party. And I think essentially what happened was that the GOP came on very strong with the religiosity as a core component of what it does, and that the Democratic Party essentially rolled over. I hear often from my readers, who are my more liberal readers, who are embarrassed by my mm-hmm. professing faith, as if this is this is a terrible thing, and how dare you be so unenlightened, which sort of tells me about the distance that we have traveled, I guess, in the time since then.
I wonder if we could pinpoint it even into the 70s. Would you agree that Jimmy Carter might be a pivotal figure here as someone on the left side of the political spectrum, but our first born-again president?
Yeah, I think Jimmy – I don't know if there's been a lot of discussion or study about Jimmy Carter's role in this, but I intuit that he definitely was an important figure. He was probably the last Democratic president to really wear faith on his sleeve as sort of something that was a prime motivator in who he was and in what he did. Not to say that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were not religious, but I don't think they were religious in quite the same way and to quite the same public degree as Jimmy Carter was.
Mm-hmm. To the point where people, according to polls, don't believe Barack Obama has the faith that he has, in fact, right?
Yeah, they don't. Well, there's a lot of complicated stuff involved in that, including race and what version of Christianity, you know, you choose to believe is authentic. But yeah, I think he's had that problem to a degree. Bill Clinton has had that problem. They're not taken to be men of faith to the same degree as, say, George W. Bush was.
Leonard Pitts is my guest this half hour. He'll be speaking tonight in Des Moines. If you have a question for Leonard Pitts, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook and leave us a question or a message. If we could, Leonard, let's talk about some of the themes that you touch on in recent columns. We just heard in our news at the top of the hour a video released by this militant Islamic group, Boko Haram, of the girls, these more than 200 schoolgirls abducted from their beds at a boarding school in Nigeria. And now they have this video, and they say they will exchange the girls for prisoners. You write, obviously before this video was released, in a column that the act of terror was also an act of fear, and extremist Islam is scared of little girls and the women they might grow up to be. Explain the perspective you see here of these extremists.
Well, I think that when you look at the abduction of these girls in Nigeria, when you look at the attack on Malala Yousafzai in Pakistan, when you look at, I believe this was also in Pakistan, if I remember correctly, the men who drove by on motorcycles and splashed acid on some girls in school, it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to see that there is a certain amount of that these people are facing the idea of girls being educated with a certain amount of desperation. Apparently, it is threatening to them in fundamental and visceral ways that perhaps we in this country cannot begin to truly appreciate.
Mm-hmm. So help us appreciate that. I guess when we wonder how in the world can someone further a cause by taking schoolgirls from their boarding school. In addition to terror, of course, it terrorizes. But what does it say about your organization if you're willing to do that?
Well, I know what it says to me is, as I said in the column, is that you're cowardly and that you're scared of girls. I think what it says in the larger realm is that they are very deeply conservative. They're very deeply patriarchal societies that are profoundly threatened, and I mean threatened at the gut level, at the base level, by the idea of women raising themselves up, by the idea of women perhaps becoming smarter or more accomplished than the men in a given society. And I think that they react to that in the way that seems, I don't know, logical is the best word I can come up with, logical to them, which is with this violence. It is interesting to me the disconnect between the message that terrorists wish to give to the rest of the world and the message that is received by the rest of the world. It seems to me that those two things almost never line up, and the disconnect has probably been never more profound than at this moment when they've kidnapped these little girls as an expression of their discontent with the idea of women, girls being educated.
In fact, as you point out in your column, Boko Haram translates as Western education is a sin. So we don't understand it because we are Western educated in their eyes. If we were educated along their lines, we would understand it more.
I think it's the whole idea and sort of the problem of fundamentalism to begin with, the idea that nothing that is worth knowing, nothing that is worth anything can exist outside of the words of whatever the holy book is that you've chosen, you know, as the guide for your life. And I think that once you get into that mindset, then you are always going to be in dangerous territory. Once you decide that everything that is worth knowing was written in this book, and that's not to denigrate, you know, any holy book of any religion, but once you decide that nothing that is worth knowing can be outside of this book, then you're going to be on very dangerous and very, very tricky ground.
Leonard Pitts, another one of your recent articles looks, we're between Mother's Day and Father's Day, so yeah. The importance of fathers, the absence of fathers, the fact that the absence of fathers matters, you point to an acceptance speech given by the NBA's most valuable player.
Yeah, Kevin Durant gave this really heartfelt and very powerful acceptance speech when he won the MVP. And among the people that he thanked, or the last person that he thanked, was his mom. And he thanked her in terms that were just glowing, in terms that, as I wrote in the column, would leave you, with something in your eye and maybe clearing your throat. But it occurred to me, and I went back and tried to find the entire speech, and it occurred to me that the one thing that I had not heard in any of that was any mention of his father. And it turns out there is a mention of his father in the speech, but it's shorter and much more perfunctory and a lot less emotional. And what I took from that, you know, Durant's father was a guy who abandoned the family, and by his own account was immature and selfish when he was a younger man. And what I took from that dichotomy is that Durant, even though he has achieved professionally beyond the imaginations of most of us, there's still a scar inside. There's still something that he feels that he should have had from his father that he did not get because his father chose to be absent. And the point that I wanted to make is simply that, you know, we tend to believe or we tend to behave as if fathers do not matter. We tend to believe as if there's nothing that father brings to the table that a committed and determined and strong woman cannot bring. And I think that the evidence, even in the case of an accomplished man like Kevin Durant, the evidence suggests otherwise.
You say that we can trace the absence of fathers back to a changing sense of morality. How did that morality get changed, and what is the sense of that change?
I think that the sexual revolution, for all the good and the undeniable good that it did, I think it also sold women a bill of goods. There was this whole idea that was sort of central to the sexual revolution of if it feels good, do it, and sort of sex without consequences. And what it turns out to have been in reality is sex without consequences for men. Because as a man, you can have sex with multiple partners and go on about your life. But if one of those multiple partners has children, then she can't go on, you know, sort of carefree and willy-nilly because suddenly she's got this obligation. And we as a society do not extract as much, we do not heap as much scorn on the father who abandons his family as we do on the mother who abandons her family. So as a man, you sort of essentially you've got to get out of jail free card. As a man who has not been involved with his children's lives, you can still go and hold your head up in polite society and still be regarded as a good person. You cannot do that, or it's more difficult to do that, let's say, as a woman.
So what I see you saying, the path to improve this situation is to make men, fathers, more accountable, to heap scorn as a society on these fathers?
I think shame gets a bad rap. I believe that it would be a very good thing if we tended to regard deadbeat dads or fathers who refuse to be involved with their children with at least the same degree of antipathy that we have toward mothers who do the same thing, that we regard them as equally deserving of our scorn or of our anger or of our sense of something profound having been betrayed. We have it's interesting to me that when I make the statement that fathers matter, it is in some quarters regarded as a controversial statement. We have grown into this idea that a child is okay so long as he has a committed mother and a quote unquote father figure. And you can see the fallacy in that thinking by noting the simple fact that no one has ever in the history of the English language used the term mother figure. Mm. We understand that when mother is gone, you know, no woman, you know, that comes into life. I mean, she can do certain things. She can be helpful, but she cannot replace what you have lost when mother is gone. With father, we say father figure. Well, I'm sorry. With due respect to stepfathers everywhere, and I am one of them, when biological dad is gone, it's my contention that a child loses something that only biological dad can bring back.
Leonard Pitts, my guest, talking about a column that keyed off the acceptance speech of Kevin Durant, MVP in the NBA named recently. We posted a link to the video of Durant's speech on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. And listeners, you can reach out and have a question for Leonard Pitts if you'd like. What role do you think opinion writing plays in our current media landscape? 1-866-780-9100. A jumping off point for a recent column, a different one, was addressed the state of journalism, a new PBS program called A Fragile Trust, Plagiarism, Power, Jason Blair at the New York Times. Jason Blair is something we haven't heard in our news for a number of years. Remind us, who was Jason Blair?
Jason Blair was the figure at the center of one of the biggest scandals in journalism history. He was the guy who was a star reporter, a rising star at the New York Times, who it turned out had been lying for years in print, had claimed to have interviewed people he had never met, had claimed to have been places he had never been, had claimed to have seen things he had never seen.
Mm-hmm. And how much damage do you think his work, his case, did to the profession of journalism?
I think his case did a tremendous amount of damage to the world of journalism. But what was interesting to me is to note how many people, and the Times noted this, I believe, in a story, how many people who were involved in Jason Blair's stories, how many people who were reported upon, never bothered to correct the misinformation because they assumed this was the way things were done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a perception problem out there that faces American journalism that Jason Blair exacerbated, but also that Jason Blair, uncovered.
Well, what do you think about efforts today in the broadcast media, print media, today's newspapers, broadcast media, to check reporting and sources? Do you think we've continued to slip there?
I think that at best, speaking specifically of print journalism, we're probably just fighting a holding action. You've got to remember that print journalism is shrinking. In terms of budget, in terms of personnel, in terms of bodies in the newsroom, so at the very best, we're fighting a holding action. In terms of broadcast news, cable television news, I don't know that I have ever been really impressed with, or have recently been impressed, I should say, with their efforts in that regard.
Mm-hmm. One recent column of yours has the headline: "Let's put the war on drugs behind us." Why do you say that should end, and in what sense do you think it should end?
I have come to the conclusion, which is amazing for me. I'm surprised to hear myself say this, but I think that drugs need to be decriminalized. I believe that the war on drugs, by any measure, has been a failure. I look at the numbers provided by LEAP, which is an advocacy group, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and one of the things that they say, which never ceases to amaze me, is that in the 42 years now of the drug war, we have spent over $1 trillion. We have jailed 40 million people, and we've seen drug use rise by 2,800%. That, to me, is the definition of having failed. I think that I think that this government could really use $1 trillion right now, $1 trillion that we spent watching drugs rise. And I think that we could probably spend a fraction of that treating drugs as a healthcare issue.
Yeah. Help go on that path, because help us picture society without this war on drugs, because the fear is, of course, without the war, it would be even worse. Our society would be taken over by drugs. Our youngsters would grow up in a stew pot of various drugs without some sort of control.
Our society is already taken over by drugs. It's hard to imagine where do we go up from 2,800%? And what is really interesting is another statistic that LEAP provides, which is that drug addiction, as opposed to drug use, of drug addiction has stayed steady for over 100 years, 3%. So I find that very telling. What I would like to see is some of the treasure that has been directed toward kicking in doors and directed toward arresting people and hauling them away, directed toward getting them off the use of drugs, those people who are addicted. And frankly, some of that treasure also directed toward a public relations campaign educating people to the dangers of certain drugs. I find it very telling that nobody ever prohibited the use of cigarettes, but simply by 40 years of telling us that these things kill us, we have seen cigarette use take a precipitous nosedive to the point where it's not unheard of, but it's certainly a lot rarer than it was when I was a child, when everybody smoked everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Sam is with us from Cedar Rapids. Sam, thanks for calling. Your question or comment for Leonard Pitts?
Oh, hi. I was just calling in regards to the thing earlier about Kevin Durant and the deadbeat dad. And he talked about the mother figure and how that's not something that is frequently heard, and how losing of the biological father can play certain roles. Mm-hmm. How would this affect, like, same-sex couples with you've got two dads or two mothers?
Can you, okay, Sam, good. Can you have two mothers and have a father figure? I don't know.
Yeah, the question is, I really don't know. I don't know that there's been research done. What we need to determine is, okay, does the absence of father affect the child because the child feels emotionally, okay, this man had the opportunity to stay involved in my life and instead abandoned me. And so therefore, you know, the child has all these bad outcomes. Or is there something you know, at a more fundamental biological level? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I guess when we talk about, say, two lesbian mothers,
right,
an artificial insemination, and a youngster growing up never having known a father, really, and having,
right,
two parents that happen to be mothers.
And that has been his norm or her norm.
Exactly.
So I don't know that there are any negative effects from that. I'd be interested in seeing some research on that.
Have you written about this?
No, that's been the one one area that I've tended to sort of steer clear of because it is such a difficult area, and I don't have any facts upon which to base a conclusion one way or another.
We have a few minutes left. Let's hear about your new novel, Free Man. It takes place in the first few months following the Confederate surrender and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. A central figure there, Sam, a runaway slave, once worked for the Union Army, decides to leave Philadelphia, the safer North, to get to return to war-torn South. Tell us, why does he want to go back? What do you want to accomplish with this figure?
Sam goes walking from Philadelphia down to Mississippi in search of Tilda, who is his wife, whom he has not seen in 15 years. And the last time he saw her, she was crying and cursing his name because she held him responsible for getting their son killed on an ill-advised escape attempt. So he is going back out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of irresolution, that there was something that she should have had a chance to say to him that never was said. And he's going back to find her because he loves her, and he never stopped loving her.
Mm-hmm. Why did you create this figure? Is there a bigger message here?
Well, it's based – I've wanted to write this book or some book like this ever since I read Leon Litwack's book, Been in the Storm So Long, which is a history book. About the phenomenon of slaves walking across mountains and meadows and counties and states to reconstitute their families. That just struck me as a very powerful expression of love and enduring love that really is not widely known. And I wanted to – it just struck me as the bones of a very powerful story.
Leonard Pitts, we have a minute or so left. Where do you do your best writing? Office situation, how should we picture you?
picture me hunched over my desk, my desktop, my Mac in my office at home. But I'll tell you, as a columnist, you learn how to write anywhere. I wrote one column standing up in an airport lobby with the computer based on a garbage can. So
whenever it strikes you, I assume an idea hit you or something you saw in that airport struck you as worth a column.
No, it was deadline time, and I was flying on the red eye, and I had work to do, and this is where I ended up doing it.
So finally, in an age when everyone can have a blog and an opinion to go along with it, is opinion writing still important and relevant?
I think it is. I think, you know, blogs have their place, and certainly blogs have done, you know, important things. But I think that there's something to be said for the tradition of opinion writing with the resources of an actual real newsroom behind it.
Okay, very good. Our time has come to an end. Leonard Pitts, Jr., visiting Iowa tonight. He'll be speaking at the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa's Protecting Faith and Freedom Annual Award Dinner to be held tonight in Des Moines. And great to have you in Iowa, Leonard Pitts, and really wonderful talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll talk with some locally grown columnists. Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, also Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register, and editorial cartoonist Brian Duffy. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last year, over 40% of Iowa USDA licensed dog breeders were cited for violations to the Animal Welfare Act. Tomorrow on this program, a look into the hidden world of puppy mills in Iowa, large-scale dog breeders. Tomorrow, the problems associated with them. Today, we're talking with columnists. In the first half hour, we talked with Leonard Pitts, who is a syndicated columnist for the Miami Herald, and he's speaking tonight in Des Moines. This half hour, we want to talk with a number of columnists here in Iowa, including Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register in our Des Moines studio. Rekha, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Ben.
I wanted to talk about some of the themes that you hit on in some of your columns recently, but it was interesting, I bet you have something to say about this. We had at the top of the hour news the Boko Haram video released of these the abduction of these more than 200 schoolgirls. Mm. Just a heartbreaking thing that's captured the attention of many around the world. Mm-hmm. Leonard Pitts saying the act of terror was also an act of fear, fearing what these girls will grow up to, the type of women they will grow up to be. I wonder what your thoughts are on this.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that, you know, this has been the defining factor in most fundamentalisms, actually, not just the Taliban, not just in Islam, but also in Christian fundamentalism, in Hindu fundamentalism. There's a very common trend, which is if girls are empowered into strong women, then somehow it's going to threaten patriarchal societies, which indeed it will. So education is one of the biggest factors in empowering young women or empowering any group of people. And that's why, you know, from Malala Yousafzai to these girls in Nigeria, they're trying to block that.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see this going as more women become aware and educated?
You know, unfortunately, I see it happening in cycles, because in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, women, actually girls, were empowered before we got into a situation of geopolitical struggles between the USSR and the U.S., especially in the case of Afghanistan, where girls were getting a very good education. And then the U.S. came in and started funding organizations that were the precursors to the Taliban as a proxy war against the Soviet Union. So it's not that all of a sudden girls are getting an education around the world and we have to, you know, worry about protecting that. It's that they have had educations a lot in the past, but for various rather dishonorable reasons, we have supported groups that are opposed to that because we thought that they would wage war on our behalf against other powers. So, I mean, I think, you know, as I've been talking to political candidates for the Senate recently, for the U.S. Senate from Iowa, one question that's come up a lot is, to what extent do we wage wars of intervention or get involved on the basis of human rights? And this is an excellent case of that. To what extent should the U.S. intervene, whether militarily or in other ways in terms of sanctions and assistance to rebel organizations, purely because of human rights issues and concerns, and by that I include women's rights in other parts of the world? And generally what I'm hearing is, unless there's a direct U.S. interest involved, then we shouldn't intervene. And I think that that's something we really need to start thinking about and having conversations about.
We are, after all, though, a war-weary country, and will be for a few years to come at least, Rekha.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not saying military. I do not support military intervention unless it's absolutely as a last resort against, you know, against genocide. But in cases like this, I think that there are other kinds of intervention that can and maybe should have been taken sooner. Mm-hmm. We didn't do anything when the news reports of this first came out. We considered it an internal affair. And, you know, what we like to call civil wars in other countries are often just acts of aggression by rebel groups that really the victims need our support in various ways.
I see in a lot of your columns you certainly have religion as a theme running through many of them, controversy surrounding religion. You wrote a recent column about the race for the open Senate seat, about U.S. Former U.S. Attorney Matt Whitaker,
yes.
Also a GOP candidate for the open Senate seat to be left by Senator Harkin, and his position on support, what a senator would need to do to support federal judges. What's the point you wanted to make in that column?
The point, and actually this is part of an ongoing series that I'm working on, which is about conflicts between the separation of church and state, or religion and state, because it's not just Christianity, that we are seeing around Iowa. And they're taking place in many venues, and we can talk about that in, you know, after I've done subsequent columns that I'm working on. But in this particular case, it was a debate between the Republican candidates for Senate to replace Tom Harkin. And it was sponsored by the Iowa Family Leader, which, as everyone knows, is a Christian evangelical, I would say, right-wing organization. And the question was asked by a national moderator who I think is a frequent Fox News contributor. The question was asked, you know, it's easy to say that when it comes to supporting judges, nominees for federal judicial positions, it, you know, you can't just say, I'm going to turn down Barack Obama's nominees because they're liberal. So what criteria would you use, he asked each of the candidates for Senate, what criteria would you find to turn down Barack Obama's nominees? And Matt Whitaker said they would have to have a biblical perspective. And he was asked New Testament or Old Testament. And Matt Whitaker said New Testament. He said, I'm a New Testament guy. And, you know, I would be really suspicious of them if they don't have that perspective. Now, that is, he should know as a former U.S. attorney that completely flies in the face of the Constitution, where it says there can be no religious basis for, you know, appointment to a particular office based on somebody's religion or lack of religion. And yet people say it with impunity all the time. Candidates say it. You know, it's used in different contexts. And I think that people need to be called out on it when that happens. That's not what we are as a nation.
You had some reaction to that column, Rekha, too, a letter to the editor from a reader in Urbandale, I see, that making the point to you that saying, you know, the Bible exercised a great deal of influence on the fathers of this nation in forming our Constitution.
I mean, personal. Everybody can be personally informed by their religious beliefs, and people who write, you know, the Constitution or pieces of the Constitution or any other document can have faith as part of you know, their basic orientation and outlook on life. But that doesn't mean that the U.S. Constitution allows for this kind of infringing on separation of church and state. We are not a theocracy. And in fact, you know, we are constantly railing, and especially members of the religious right are railing against other countries that are theocracies for imposing their view of religion. And just what we were talking about in Nigeria, you know, these rebel groups that want to impose a strict notion of Islam to repress the rights of people. Well, you know, we're not that different if we're going to impose a litmus test. And quite frankly, you know, based on the responses of the other candidates in this debate, most of them seem to feel about the same way, even if they didn't go as far as he did in expressing it.
Rekha, how do you feel about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling then?
Very disturbing.
This is the one that allows prayer at the beginning of a city council meeting and other government meetings. But those who support it say it's – what is the harm in that?
The harm in that –
We are predominantly Christian. I don't know if this community was. But what is the harm in that?
The harm in that is that this country was set up in part, you know, people came here for religious freedom because they didn't have religious freedom in their own countries because there was persecution. I, as an atheist or as an agnostic or as a Muslim or as a Hindu, have every right to be represented by my government, as much right as a person who does have a religion and, you know, feels strongly about it. But these are not religious institutions. City councils, school boards of all things are not religiously based institutions. Now, certainly, if it's a Catholic school or a Christian school, sure, they can pray. But these are taxpayer-funded institutions.
Rekha Basu is with us, columnist for the Des Moines Register. Let's be joined now in our Des Moines studio as well by a newer columnist for the Des Moines Register, Kyle Munson, who's been on this program before. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us, joining Rekha, to talk about the work of a columnist. Let's talk about some of touch on a couple of your columns recently. One interesting one. You are more of a sort of a, if I can put it this way, a storytelling columnist. You bring out the stories from Iowa that don't make it into the headlines. Very interesting. You have the column that points out we have 99 counties, well known here in Iowa, but we have 100 county seats, and there's a controversy surrounding that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I kind of have what sometimes I call the unbeat, or it's a non-beat. Sometimes it's off-beat, I guess. But, you know, I'm casting a wide net, and I am looking for some of the most interesting storytelling moments and characters around the state. And, my attention turned to Lee County in far southeast Iowa this year. Now, on one hand, it's an old story. I mean, anybody who knows Iowa, yeah, we have 99 counties. It's become a routine kind of parade route for politicians mm-hmm. when they campaign. But we have one extra county seat because, you know, in a dispute that spans now, you know, three centuries since the 1800s, Lee County has two county seats. It's been a rivalry between Fort Madison in the north and Keokuk in the south, two, you know, storied Mississippi River towns mm-hmm. that have had this, you know, I guess this stalemate for so long.
Uh-huh. And the controversy, why the impasse, why does it matter? Can't we allow this?
I guess
we have for three centuries.
But it's erupted yet again. So what happened, what made it, you know, arguably newsworthy this year is that we have just a whole new round of debate. Can we change this? Can we have one county seat? Can we centralize? Can we save money? And, you know, into the fray stepped this city councilwoman from a town that's kind of poised between the two county seats. And she now is leading this, you know, committee of citizens appointed by the county board of supervisors. And so there is, this is the first serious effort in a long time to solve this ancient problem in Lee County.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, you also write about something that's happening. Is it, it's coming up, this charity solo lawn tractor ride for Memorial Day. This harkens back to a film that many of our listeners have seen, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's, you know, I, as the Iowa columnist, occasionally I'll find myself writing something tractor-related, which in one sense is
inevitable
very—
Inevitable in Iowa.
It is very inevitable. Yeah, this is an Omaha man, Jerry Hoagie, who's a lifelong truck driver, but— what's interesting, so he says he was not inspired by the Strait story, which people might remember. There was a man, Alvin Strait, who, it was a real story that was covered in the Register. He rode his, he had a scheme to ride his long tractor to Wisconsin to visit his ailing brother, and it became a David Lynch film eventually, 1999.
Marvelous film.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yeah,
yes. The Strait story, if you haven't seen it, make sure you do.
Yeah, yeah, very elegant kind of classic, now, you know, now it's seen as a classic Iowa film. Anyway, so this has been on Jerry Hoagie's bucket list, and so he had this scheme to ride his lawn tractor across the state of Iowa over Memorial Day weekend to raise money for the Wounded Warrior Project. Well, through, you know, thanks to some friends, he'll be riding a slightly larger tractor. But I ended up writing about his saga and just kind of the circumstances that led to it. And in the process, of course, inevitably I end up finding another man who is riding his John Deere tractor across the country, starting on the East Coast and ending up on the West Coast, and he will be driving through Iowa.
I don't know.
Just, also,
I don't know how it strikes
Warrior
you
Project.
And Reka, if driving a tractor, great distance. Just I guess I'm not getting the appeal of it, but maybe you'd know Kyle. If there's some unhidden appeal, a hidden appeal there.
You're talking to a couple people here who, you know, routinely ride their bikes across Iowa. So tractor, bike, I don't know, maybe the tractor's smarter. At least you're not sweating as much. I don't know.
I've never actually been on one, so I can't say how I would feel about it. It might be a really novel experience, though.
Who knows? We've got to try it, I guess, to deliver a criticism about it. Also joining Kyle Munson and Reka Basu of the Des Moines Register in our Des Moines studio, Brian Duffy is with us, editorial cartoonist, known well to Iowa readers. Brian Duffy, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your cartoons continue to appear in newspapers and on websites nationwide through King Features Syndicate. And you are presently, I think, the staff editorial cartoonist for KCCI-TV in Des Moines?
Not anymore. We're discussing something else. So,
okay.
And those are animated cartoons too, yeah.
Okay. And but you do some cartoonist work for the city newspaper there in Des Moines, the City View.
Yes.
Actually, I have one of those here with me because I wanted to – well, you could share one of your favorites recently. I have a – perhaps you could describe it. It is – I'll read the caption of it. The delegates at the 1st Congressional District GOP convention decided to streamline the size of their platform by removing a plank or two. Describe, if you could, Brian, what we're seeing.
Well, the first district delegation had discussed what their platform was going to be, and they took out the plank involving traditional marriage. And that was something that I didn't see a lot of coverage on many other places. And I drew a cartoon on that because that is something that is usually the first plank on the Republican state platform. And it created just a huge stir. So that's what the cartoon is about, that they wanted to – they were saying that they were, in essence, streamlining it. But what the undercurrent message was is that younger generation is looking at this entire situation of gay marriage and non-traditional marriage, as they like to call it, and move away from the family leader's position and also the Republicans' platform's position, state platform on that. So it's a newer generation looking at this subject and saying, we don't really agree with this. And that's where I think you're going to be seeing some pretty big battles in the Republican Party, not just in the state. And I pulled that out of there because from the first congressional district, because I do state cartoons and I started my own state syndication because I still wanted to continue to draw state cartoons. So I approached quite a few different newspapers, and I now have – I now stretch river to river from Burlington and
Hey, that's,
and
our, that's our name, Brian.
Sorry. I've been doing it longer than you have.
Oh,
all the way
our,
over to Sioux City.
Oh, we've started our own controversy here. All right, go ahead.
All the way over to Sioux City and papers, about 40 papers in between. So I'm able to kind of touch on everything that's going on in the state. But the one thing that I've noticed, though, and I'm going to kind of editorialize a little bit here on how content is disseminated, is that I found that I have to put a lot more words in my cartoons because not everybody is getting the news from the same sources anymore.
Oh, that is very interesting. So we had much more in common when there were three TV networks and public television and we didn't have this digital age. So
yes,
people are being informed, pigeonholing their news consumption, and so it changes your need to educate before you make the joke or create the outrage.
Oh, tremendously so. And it is a huge change because it used to be, and this was the philosophy of an editorial cartoonist, is that we were the type of people that came off the hills after a battle was fought and shoot the wounded. generally, you know, it's a simple way of saying we allowed the story to get out there and for people to consume it, understand it, and then we would comment on it. And since editorial cartooning is not a positive art form, then, you know, we commented appropriately on it. So now that is so fractured, I found that I really have to add a lot more words into the cartoon and background into the cartoon to be able to get that same message across.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, laughing is something that an editorial cartoonist likes to create?
Not necessarily.
Perhaps outrage. What are your possible goals with it, with a cartoon?
To inform people about my opinion, maybe even the subject matter a little bit more. You know, one thing that I think has hurt the profession, which is swiftly going downhill, by the way, is the fact that I think that too many of the cartoonists out there had become just kind of jokesters. You know, there was no bite to the cartoon. And if you looked at a previous generation's cartoonists and what they'd produced, they had a lot more bite in them. And, I mean, you could really – you had the image and you had the words, and they could really make a statement in that very short span of time that they were given to get the idea – their idea across. And I think that that's one thing that that has been lacking over the last, I'd say, about 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And why has that bite slowly disappeared? Is it due to the digital age again?
Well, it's due to the fact that a lot of newspapers, one of the ways that they've decided to save money is to dump just about every editorial cartoonist out there. And I probably will be the last editorial cartoonist in Iowa. And I think that our profession, unless something changes, will – you won't see them in newspapers for sure within the next, I would say, 30 years. And if you can find them on the web, good luck there, because the changes that the digital age is doing to the media is it's fracturing it, and it's to the point where you're going to be seeing small little spots or they'll be getting people that'll be watching or reading something in just little pockets here and there on websites.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only place that you'll see some comic strips, actually. In fact, just last week I put on my Twitter feed that the New York Post dropped all of their comic strips.
We've got just over a minute left. I wanted to see if any of you or all of you had a quick reaction to news this weekend that people are buzzing about. Michael Sam became the first openly gay player to be drafted into the NFL this weekend. ESPN carried that draft, his reaction live, including the celebratory kiss between Sam and his boyfriend. Will any of you be writing about it?
I guess I don't have any column plans at the moment. I mean, I think it's good news.
Reka, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that it's great and that it's not really – I mean, for me, it's not that unusual to hear about anymore. So I don't sort of gasp and say, oh, my God, because I think more and more sports icons have been coming out. I think it's wonderful that they're feeling comfortable enough to do that. And, again, you know, what you were asking me before about the separation of church and state and why is that an issue that we should be concerned about, it's an issue because it's something that a lot of gay people have been persecuted on the basis of religion and interpretation verses of the Bible, and God knows there are many. But, you know, this is a – I think this is a very interesting cultural shift that's taking place, that we have same-sex marriage in Iowa, that icons are coming out as being openly gay, and it's been creating some backlash.
Right. And it was interesting. The first half hour, Leonard Pitts, I asked him about same-sex marriage, and he hadn't touched it in a column because he thought it wasn't quite – ripe for the picking? I'm not sure. Hmm. It was interesting.
Really?
It That's kind weird. Of showed that Miami Herald and Iowa, we've lived with this for a few years now, haven't we?
My goodness. That is fascinating. I didn't realize that.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to have to say goodbye. I have so many questions I would have loved to put to all of you, but we'll have to save that for another time. Thank you for coming into
Sounds
our studio.
Good.
Rekha Basu, Kyle Munson, and Brian Duffy. I'm sorry the time was so short, but I was delighted to have you on our program.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on our program, we'll talk about the hidden world of puppy mills in Iowa, large-scale dog breeders and the problems connected with those. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.